Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Ask America's top litigators to name their best and brightest, and Michael Tygar would be at the top of this list. Known for his mesmerizing courtroom presence and his meticulous trial preparation, Tygar actually argued his first case before the Supreme Court only 3 years out of law school. He's represented many controversial clients since then, among them Lynn Stewart, Terry Nichols, Angela Davis, John Connolly, and members of the Chicago Seven. In a 2002 book, Fighting Injustice, Tygar remembered back to not wanting to become a, quote, well-to-do and skilled but irrelevant lawyer at the outset of his career. And since then, he's taken on issues that he feels very passionate about, including the draft, free speech, government surveillance, the death penalty, judicial independence, and international human rights. It is my distinct honor and pleasure to introduce to you, and please help me in welcoming Michael Tygar.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here at a law school that, at least from talking to the folks who teach here and looking at your website, is interested in welcoming students who plan to go out and practice law in the most meaningful way that I know, by representing folks with real concerns. Yes, it's true that I thought I wanted to be a litigator. I used to tell a story that, you know, I learned to try cases by going out and doing them, taking pro bono cases, just like my mom and dad taught me how to swim by rowing me out in the middle of the lake and throwing me in. And then my mother came to a program, and I told that story, and she stood up and said, "Honey, we weren't trying to teach you how to swim." I want to talk today about the advertised subject, the enemy combatant, but I want to put it in a context. And the context is that of the ABA Roundtable on the Independence of the Judiciary in the October 2005 issue, in which I was one of the folks who participated, and you can read it. But, and I suggest you do, because among the participants were a retired Justice Utter of the Washington State Supreme Court, Christine Durham, who's the Chief Justice of the Utah Supreme Court, Congressman Feeney, of course, some other folks, but state court judges, as well as somebody like me who spent most of his litigating life in the federal court. The fact of the matter is that the courts in which you will practice law, whether you represent a homeowner that's going to lose their house or somebody whose appliance payments have fallen behind and the sheriff may come and seize their appliance, or somebody whose civil rights have been violated, or somebody in a domestic relations dispute, or whatever, the courts in which you are going to practice law are under siege. They are caught in the crossfires of the culture wars, and their independence, that is to say, the power and duty of judges to decide cases based on their understanding of their independent duty, is under attack. We see that most dramatically, of course, in the federal courts. Hence the subject that I've chosen to talk about today. This is not a new fact. Those who wrote the American Constitution understood that an independent judicial branch needed to be created in order to confront excesses of executive power, and in order to confront the times when the legislature would overstep its bounds. In Marbury versus Madison, Chief Justice Marshall took up both of those threads of argument, after all. The case is remembered because he affirmed the right of the Supreme Court and duty of the Supreme Court to hold unconstitutional congressional statutes that were in excess of the Congress's delegated power. But the part of the opinion that hacked off Thomas Jefferson the most, and I mean hacked him off, those two people hated each other. Jefferson said of Marshall, "If he were to tell me the time of day while looking at a clock, I would go ask somebody else what time it was." In his second term, Jefferson was so enraged by the judicial independence stand of his own nominee, Justice Johnson, that he had his then Attorney General, Caesar Rodney, write a memorandum dealing with what Jefferson called the leprosy of the bench. That's just to give you an idea. Anyway, in the constitutional debates, Patrick Henry of Virginia, yes, Patrick Henry, doubted that the Constitution was good because he said this Chief Justice that you've created might not be strong enough to resist the advances, to resist the pretensions and designs of a president who arrives at the head of an army, who claims, that is, the need to do X and Y and Z and to have it be completely unreviewable because, after all, the president is commander-in-chief. Yes, and Patrick Henry, for that reason, doubted whether the Constitution should be adopted. So what we face today is not a new problem. Indeed, Jefferson himself earned the rebuke of the Marshall Court for rounding up Aaron Burr's alleged Confederates and subjecting them to military tribunals. We could talk a little more about that, maybe in the question period, but that's a kind of run-up to this case, the enemy combatant case. This fellow Padilla, or Padilla, I think his family says he wants to have it pronounced, it's a little hard to know because he's been in custody for about 3 years now, and he hadn't been able to see anybody except interrogators and the people who bring him food. So the question of how he wishes to have his name pronounced is not one that you or I can opine upon at this moment. The Supreme Court of the United States did say that if he were to get judicial review of the conditions of confinement, it would have to be, given the old habeas rules, somewhere near Charleston, South Carolina, where he's being held, and that's where the litigation is taking place now. But let me review the facts. This is a man who is a citizen of the United States. He entered the United States, and the allegation was that he came with a script, a plan, to organize al-Qaeda cells and commit terrorist acts against apartment buildings and other civilian installations, and he needed to be held as an enemy combatant. The idea that a citizen could be an enemy combatant is not a wholly new one. The Jefferson example gives it, you know, lets you know. And, of course, during the Second World War, there was this Japanese relocation, a precedent on which the government continues to rely, where we rounded up people, citizens of the United States, most of them of Japanese ancestry, and put them in concentration camps. Now, 60 years after that event, a courageous federal district judge found out that the Supreme Court decision was based on a fraud committed on the courts by the United States government that didn't tell the truth and set aside the judgment. But the Supreme Court precedent is still there. So Padilla gets arrested. He's held now in custody. He sees his interrogators. They interrogate him. Now, it is no longer pretended that he truly was going to blow up apartment buildings and lead al-Qaeda cells and so on. It was a little funny, the allegation from the beginning, but that is no longer the government's position. The government's litigation position today is, and I spoke to the lawyers just last week, that he was on a battlefield in Afghanistan and there took up arms. He held arms, and they were going to shoot or did shoot at American soldiers. Now, what's the source of this allegation? Certified, too, by an official of the Defense Department who got it from an intelligence officer who heard it from somebody who interrogated somebody in a place where people get interrogated under torture, such as Jordan or Egypt. And so maybe it's true and maybe it's not. I pause here for a footnote. The Senate voted 90-9. To formalize the rule and say no torture. Well, the United States is party to a treaty that was signed and ratified during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, the famous liberal who, notoriously tried to keep our national security apparatus weak. But anyway, the treaty is signed and the Senate ratified it. And 90-9, Senate said, you know, that really is the rule. And now Vice President Cheney says, yes, but the CIA should still be able to do it. Right? That's the official position of the Vice President of the United States, that a norm 200 years in the making shouldn't have to be observed. So the factual allegations with respect to Mr. Padilla are those. And now he sits in a brig in Charleston. No lawyer, only the interrogators. Why is the government doing this? That would be the first question, wouldn't it? Well, The Bush administration wanted to create a category called enemy combatant to create a legal precedent permitting the executive branch to round up citizens of the United States and hold them indefinitely without counsel. They wanted a judicial precedent that said that. That's a little scary. But, of course, if you're not going to be a dissenting person that might attract the undesirable attention of federal national security types, maybe you don't want to worry about it. I'll get to that in a minute. Now, however, the allegations are narrower, and the allegation would be, or the precedent would be, that if someone had somehow engaged in some armed resistance to United States forces, that perhaps they could be held indefinitely in the United States without charging them with anything, without counsel, and without meaningful judicial review. What's wrong with that picture? Well, if that picture is permitted to be the law, what's wrong with it could be something about something called due process. And not in the abstract, but in a quite practical sense. Most first-year procedure students study a case or a line of cases that begin with Fuentes versus Chevin, the case of Mrs. Fuentes, whose appliances were seized by the sheriff because she didn't keep up the payments. Under a Florida procedure where the creditor would go down and get the sheriff to issue an order saying, go out and get those appliances, without any pre-seizure hearing or process to guarantee a prompt post-seizure resolution. Denies due process. Why does it deny due process? Because the sheriff doesn't know whether she's kept up her payments or not. The sheriff is just relying on what somebody said. There's no way to see if it's reliable. The sheriff is not a judicial officer. The sheriff doesn't pretend to be neutral. And so it is the lack of guarantees of reliability and the lack of alleged neutrality, or lack of demonstrated neutrality, that is the hallmark of due process with respect to Mrs. Fuentes' stove. When we get into questions of personal liberty, we might want to ratchet it up just a notch or two, remembering, after all, that unreviewed detention, the right to review of otherwise unreviewable detention, is at the root of habeas corpus, right? The most basic of the rights that are supposed to be judicially protected, not only in the American Constitution, but now throughout the world. That was the first major decision, for example, of the European Court of Human Rights. And so the question of the enemy combatant and the question of what kind of review raises, for me at least, the whole range of other issues that are in the second half of the title of this talk. I already mentioned that President Jefferson was rebuked by the Supreme Court when he rounded up Aaron Burr's Confederates and had them held supposedly without access to any judicial review, and the Supreme Court said no. Justice Ginsburg has written a wonderful article that focuses on that and other cases in the early history of the United States in Georgetown Law Review a few years ago. The Japanese relocation case I have mentioned, in the wake of the Second World War, the Supreme Court decided that the declaration of martial law in Hawaii was unwise. The issue for us today, given the conflict in Iraq, given the position of the administration, given cases like Padilla, the issue for us today is, what are we going to do about this system of separation of powers in a time when the executive branch is claiming the right, the prerogative, to interfere with individual liberties in the way that it has? And why is it important to everybody in the room? Well, I mean what I say at the beginning. This attack on judicial independence takes place across a whole range of judicial decisions, whether they be decisions about sentencing, decisions about the civil rights of people who are represented, or even the sort of run-of-the-mind issues about marriage and custody and things that somehow get tied up with issues of social policy, such as the rights of people whose sexual orientation is different and so on. In the federal courts, it really is an uphill battle. Because Padilla, of course, is not the only case. Now, the Fourth Circuit has recently taken a look at the Padilla case, and in a decision that proves overwhelmingly that there are many Court of Appeals judges that believed that Harriet Myers would indeed withdraw her name or would never be nominated, and that they could therefore still be in the running for a seat on the Supreme Court if they could just convince the administration that their politics were good. So a panel of Fourth Circuit judges who are actively in the running for a position on the Supreme Court, and I don't mean to be cynical about that, I mean, but I think it's a realistic position, say this. Yes, you can hold Mr. Padilla because we are at war. We're at war? Okay. Well, how are we at war? Well, the Congress authorized the use of force. I didn't see anything about war in there. We can debate the scope of the congressional resolution. A declaration of war is a solemn act that carries certain consequences. An authorization for the use of force is not a declaration of war. It just isn't. Any more than the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was a declaration of war with respect to Vietnam. The Johnson administration tried that on, and it didn't work. But then the next question is, if we are at war, with whom are we at war? Al-Qaeda, says the Fourth Circuit. We're at war with what? Al-Qaeda. That's a group called The Camp. Well, what is Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda is a loose-knit, disorganized bunch of groups operating in different places. I don't know where you go to sign up to be a member. I don't know where you go to resign if somehow you are a member. I don't know where it is. They don't get mail. You know, war, war is a state of events between sovereign nations. That is not a trivial statement. If there is a civil uprising in some country that is being put down, if there are a group of people in a city who've decided to riot in the streets, well, those are just examples of kinds of conflict that could take place. War is a very special kind of conflict. And there has never been a time in the history of the development of international law when war hasn't been something that takes place between sovereigns. Because if the people you were fighting weren't sovereign, there were a whole bunch of other rules. Such as, could you seize their ships as prizes? What did you do with the prisoners? I mean, these are issues with which folks have dealt with for 1,000 years. But no, we're at war with Al-Qaeda. How will we know when it's over? We'll capture Osama bin Laden? No. And Zawahiri. Well, I mean, we've killed the number two person in Al-Qaeda so many times that I think that Shirley MacLaine might be in charge of that operation. And it would be, and as your reaction indicates, laughable, except that since the Fourth Circuit panel of would-be, wannabe Supreme Court justices says that you can hold Mr. Padilla till the war is over, how will we know? It is as though someone said in 1947, Russia was our gallant ally, but the Cold War must now begin. The enemy, my friends, is international communism. Right? And then you can, you know, play out the rhetoric. How will we know when it's over? And that, by the way, is not a fanciful question to ask. In 1975, I went to Denver as court-appointed counsel for a young man named Cameron Bishop. Mr. Bishop had been indicted in 1969, but had been, by his choice, unavailable until captured in Rhode Island. And he was charged with having blown up power towers around Denver that as a protest against the Vietnam War. And the charge was laid under a provision of the United States Code called sabotage, which basically is arson, but took place during a time of war or national emergency. That was the statute. And so we asked the question, what national emergency? And into evidence came Government Exhibit 600, which was a certified copy with ribbons and seals of a declaration of national emergency. Remember, we're trying the case in 1975. The indictment had been returned in 1969. What declaration of national emergency was extant at that time? The Korean War. Yes, it was signed by President Harry Truman. Now, and so that's it? Yep, but during a national emergency. Well, I thought the Korean War was over. Silly me. And they said, well, yeah, but nobody ever said it was. The president never said it was. So I went to Georgetown Law School to Dean Adrian Fisher, who, as it happened, had been legal advisor to the State Department in 1950. Great man. He'd clerked for Louis Brandeis and Felix Frankfurter. He'd done all. Wonderful man. And he said, I remember that thing. I drafted it for the president. I said, will you come and be a witness? And he was. Now, that's dangerous, by the way. In your career, I want to tell you, you put a law professor on the stand. And the meaning of hog on ice springs to your mind. It's hard to control. It's easy to wind them up. And it's easy to flick the switch to get them started. But control can be an issue. But Dean Fisher did not disappoint. He said, we put the exhibit in front of him. He said he drafted it. And fortunately, because who knows what else would otherwise have happened, Judge Araj leaned forward to the prosecutor and said, aren't you going to object now? The prosecutor said, yes, sustained. So then he testified out of the presence of the jury, and he said the Korean War was over. Well, the Court of Appeals reversed the conviction, saying that there was a scienter, a mental element. How could you possibly know in 1969 the Korean War was still going on, so how could you commit the offense of sabotage? And for a lot of reasons that the Solicitor General didn't seek cert. Well, that's just an illustration of the problem here. This is a war against something that hardly exists under circumstance, under a resolution that doesn't say war, without any ending place. That is indeed a dangerous precedent. What does the government say to that? They say, well, listen, if Mr. Padilla truly is innocent, if he is not a threat to us, he can make that clear to his captors. He can explain it to his interrogators. Well, a couple of things wrong with that. Those who drafted Article 3 of the Constitution believed that there were these people called judges, judicial officers. Those who drafted the Fourth Amendment believed that there were judicial officers. Those who drafted the Due Process Clause and therefore had that applied to Mrs. Fuentes' stove issue thought that being able to explain it to the cops did not exactly qualify as a fair resolution. Now, in your criminal procedure class, you can side with the so-called liberal decisions or not side with the liberal decisions. Right? But I want to tell you something about your law practice. Wherever it is, you could be in Springfield, you could be in Northampton, you could be in Lowell, you could be in Williamstown. I don't know where you're going to go and practice. You get out of here, and that's just a few Massachusetts cities that I happen to know about. People are going to come in, even people that are very conservative people, and they or a member of their family will have had a run-in with the police, and then all of a sudden, they're going to want an independent judge, right? See, I've represented Republicans. I represented Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison. I represented John Connolly. You know, when Republicans get indicted, it gives them cognitive dissonance. Because they say, oh, that due process clause. And then they discover it all at once. So these values are non-trivial. The right to explain it to your interrogator. And what else is wrong with that? I said I'd return to this. It isn't simply that torture is wrong. It isn't simply that the English Revolution was fought in part to abolish the prerogative courts that had used torture. It isn't simply that the world has condemned it and the United States has signed a treaty about it. And by the way, being interrogated every day for a couple of years begins to qualify as torture, and there are decisions of the European Convention on Human Rights that say that. Being held in solitary confinement all that time makes people crazy, even if they don't beat you up. As Justice Frankfurter said, the blood of the accused is not the only hallmark of torture. People investigating crimes believe so deeply in what they're doing that they sometimes get it wrong. People who are being held, who think that if they'll just tell the story that's asked, you know, even if it's not quite true, maybe they'll be let go, give false confessions. Some of the folks released from death row and the Innocence Project, that's been exactly what it is. That's been, you know, the story. To people named Pitts and Lee in Florida, and I participated in their habeas corpus hearing down in Florida, in which the evidence was that they'd had confessions beaten out of them by a deputy named Wayne White. We know about that. But there's also the fact that, you know, the folks in charge of prosecuting crime think that their job is so important that they don't always need to be exactly truthful about the details because they got the big picture. In the Nichols case, we had an unprecedented deal with the prosecutors. We got all the FBI 302s. We had 50,000 witness statements to go through. We had thousands of interviews that we had conducted. We put on 70 witnesses in the defense case there. We did okay. Terry got acquitted of everything except the conspiracy charges and involuntary manslaughter. But that's not the point of the story. One of the government's witnesses in the Nichols case was an Army sergeant who said, I was at the Geary State Fishing Lake on a particular day, and I saw a Ryder truck. Other evidence established that was the Ryder truck that Timothy McVeigh had rented. Good enough. Next to it was parked a blue pickup truck with a white camper top. Terry Nichols had a blue pickup truck with a white camper top. So the sergeant's testimony was used to show that Nichols had been at the lake with McVeigh at the time that the bombs were being prepared, the explosive devices. We contested this. We cross-examined the sergeant back and forth. And so because we had attacked his testimony, the government introduced a prior consistent statement of the sergeant's. They're entitled to do that, right? That's all taken evidence. You know that to be true. Agent Budke of the FBI. And he said that he had met Sergeant Wall in the chow line at Fort Riley because he was up there and that's where the investigation was centered. And Sergeant Wall had told him, I saw the blue pickup truck at the Geary State Fishing Lake. Good. Now, when I cross-examine an FBI agent or anybody that the FBI has interviewed, I always go on a hunt for prior statements, even if I've been assured that I have them all. Just a little device. Agent Budke, when you saw Sergeant Wall, did you make a memorandum of the conversation with him? Because I had no writing of Agent Budke's about this event. He said, I wrote his name down. Agent Budke, when you saw Sergeant Wall, did you make a memorandum of what he told you? Because he didn't answer the question, right? Don't ever let a witness do that. Never. The nicest way is to say the question again, word for word. That makes it clear to the jury that you don't think you've got the answer. Don't ask the judge to help you yet, all right? Don't tell the teacher. You do this yourself. So he says, I wrote his name. I said, Agent, let me try this one more time. You know, let me try the question. Could I do that? Did you write down the content of what he said to you? Well, I made a lead sheet. Now, the term lead sheet I'd never heard before. Now the prosecutor's getting a little worried. He said, you made a lead sheet. Yes, there was a 302 made. Let's talk about the lead sheet. Well, the prosecutor opens his briefcase, and he gives me something, and it's an FBI 302 type statement that some other agent did interviewing this same witness. I said, well, I've seen that. I don't want that. Well, upshot of the story is we finally find the lead sheet, which is the handwritten actual notes that Agent Budke made. Turns out there are 35,000 of these things that we've never seen. The FBI has not told the prosecutors that they exist, and thus they've never reviewed them, thus we've never had them in discovery. That's right. The FBI that was investigating didn't trust the prosecutors by giving them all the stuff so that the prosecutors could do their lawyerly thing of turning it over to the defense when it was called for. Maybe the case was too important for prosecutors to handle. We get the sheet. I put it in front of the agent. I say, agent, and then I put it in front of him because we have an Elmo device that puts it on its TV screens. It's all a bunch of technology that I don't think I can understand right now if I had to do it again. And I say, agent, would you please read to the jury what you wrote? Sergeant Wall said that he saw a brown pickup truck at the lake, but he really said it was blue. I said, agent, this idea of writing down something different than what the witness tells you, was this something you learned at the FBI Academy, or is that an investigative technique that you have developed in the intervening years on your own? Now, we laugh, but, you know, human liberty is just a little too important to turn over to people who have, you know, a real hard interest in the outcome and who are existing under circumstances that don't exactly encourage candor and fairness and obedience to law. When Senator McCain stood up to support this legislation to say, hey, no more torture, he cited this officer, the Fishback, who'd participated in tortures, who knew about them, had personal knowledge, a military officer, who said, you know, they teach us about that. And they do. And he went up the chain of command to try to get something done about it and was rebuffed and rebuked at every stage. Because, as we know, and once again, I hark back to your experience. You will meet a lot of clients in this world who will be very, very upset with how they get treated in the bureaucracy. Why didn't my Social Security check come anymore? Why did they disallow my disability claim? Why am I not getting my workman's comp? You know what? You're going to find out that if the bureaucratic environment in which these folks work says you can say to hell with the public, you're encouraged to cut people's benefits, you're encouraged to behave in certain ways, or if you do behave in, you know, against the rules, nobody's going to do anything about it. That creates a culture, right? Creates a culture within which the people that are supposed to be helping and serving your clients aren't going to do it. Well, that, folks, is the challenge. It is a challenge that can be fought out at every level of the legal establishment. We are the lawyers. What that means is that we possess an independence that is guaranteed to us. That's not always honored. If we get too loud, maybe the Bar Association tries to sit on us, right? Maybe clients fall away if we take an unpopular stance. But basically and by and large, this was the fight. You and I live in the common law system, folks. What does that mean? Well, I don't know. Read an English history book or take a course in English history. from about 1601 onwards, it was the job of the English common lawyers led by Edward Coke and others to try to abolish the king's prerogative courts and reestablish some kind of an adversary system and an independent body of people to decide cases. The idea that the courts should be independent, standing indifferent between citizen and sovereign, is one that Edward Coke wrote about in 1608. So it's not a new idea. The executive branch was putting its thumb a little bit heavily on the scale in that case. The idea that the executive branch, when it assumes the mantle of commander-in-chief, should act unreviewably was debated in the Parliament in the early 1600s because someone reported that you didn't have to worry about King Charles interfering with the judiciary. He'd only do it where he thought it was necessary because he was, after all, the king. And Lord Coke, in a memorable statement, said, "God send me never to live under the law of conveniency or discretion, for if the soldier and the justice sit on the same bench, the trumpet will not let the crier speak in Westminster Hall." At least that's what he was reported as saying. Maybe he could revise and extend his remarks. I could not extemporaneously have said anything, you know, that kind of smart and jazzy, but he said it. Reinforcing the idea that lawyers and judges are supposed to be independent. What did Madison write in Federalist 45? You know, it's that impious doctrine of the old world that people are made for kings. That's what we were getting away from. And so whether it's the Social Security payment that didn't make it, the tenant whose complaint about the inadequate housing isn't being listened to, the client who comes in and says, you know, the cops behave badly, or whether it's Mr. Padilla sitting in a jail cell in Charleston. We have a job to do. And we can only do it if we struggle for and maintain the independence of the tribunals before which we're going to bring our clients' claims. Thank you. I didn't talk the whole hour for two reasons. First of all, it was my job to talk and yours to listen, and I thought you might finish your job before I finished mine. But second, I wanted to hear from you. Questions? There's one.
Yes, can we have some prescriptions for what we should do, given that we have an intangible enemy that... And certainly I think that your points are excellent, and I think you're correct. But I would also suggest that terrorists kill liberals as well as conservatives, and that basically the challenges facing the country right now vex not only lawyers, but also the administration. So where should we be going?
Okay. Let's first domestic and then foreign, okay? Reliance on the FBI and the so-called intelligence gathering abilities of the FBI is demonstrably foolish and dumb. We start with the proposition that the infrastructure of intelligence gathering and processing is broken. Go online and look how the FBI spent millions, billions to get this trilogy system, you know, computer sharing. Read some of the record of the Lynn Stewart case about lost files and destroyed files and computers that don't talk to each other. So the first thing we need to do is recognize that those who are in charge of gathering this intelligence are not, in fact, infallible, that we can't trust them. And therefore, if we can't trust them, why should we give them more unreviewable power? The question of the ability of groups that want to commit crimes in the United States... Right, that's because that's our, you know, that's the concern of domestic security. Airport security was inadequate before September 11th because the airlines didn't want to invest in efficient airport security. That's just that's a true fact. Cockpit doors were not locked and secured, a security step that Al Al had taken for years. I don't know if you've ever flown in and out of Israel, whether an Al Al flight or not. Why? Because the thought was, well, let him take the plane. We'll just fly to some other place. So there were a lot of things that you could do that had nothing whatever to do with interfering with human liberty, you know, and that weren't done for various reasons. That needs to be examined. Next, beginning in 1994, with the Clinton administration, all the anti-terrorism legislation with respect to the designation of foreign terrorist organizations said that you could get judicial review of your designation, but the evidence would be secret. Right? Now, this resulted in a lot of politically motivated decisions that were aimed at various organizations who really never should have been classified as dangerous at all, or whose classification was politically expedient, such as the People's Mujahideen, which we first listed as an FTO, and now we're arming again because we think we might use them against Iraq. In other words, these are politically motivated decisions. And the reason these politically motivated decisions got made wrongly is a lack of transparency. You know, the problem in Detroit with that case where the FBI is running an informant and they know the evidence is bum, but they're running it against some people and trying them. The list of events of which the Padilla case is just a part. Hamdi, the Supreme Court case in which the government said couldn't possibly have judicial review. The guy's a terrorist. The court says, yeah, we think judicial review. Next thing we know, he's on a plane to Saudi Arabia because he's not all that dangerous after all, even though the government has stood up in the Supreme Court of the United States and said that he is. Every single one of these instances of that I've mentioned and that now I've added to the list has to do with the executive branch acting without the independent review that an independent judiciary can provide. The justification for that is that judges can't be trusted with secrets. That is demonstrably nonsense. So the first job is to institute and insist upon procedural safeguards when these powers are exercised. The second job is to simply not believe the FBI and these other agencies when they say they need all these high-tech snoopery devices when they simply haven't been able to deal with them properly anyway. I also, at another level, you know, the problem of urban crime in the United States, and I understand it you know, of course, it operates in a lot of communities. The way to deal with potential terrorist threats, it seems to me, is to look at the whole way in which we police our communities. We could start there, because the more visible cops you have on the street, the more the police department is involved with the community. You know, all sorts of steps you take that bring crime down, right? By giving everybody in the community a sense of involvement in the process. Now, those are just a few suggestions that are ways to deal with this issue that do not involve, as I say, quite so much a threat to human liberty and represent technical things that ought to be, represent sort of technological things like cockpit doors and so on that could be studied. Now, with respect to foreign governments, in 1982, Ronald Reagan's State of the Union message says, "We support the Mujahideen of Afghanistan." That you know who that was? That was Osama bin Laden. He wasn't yet a big guy, but we were arming him. Why? Because we were kicking the Soviets out. So we supported the folks that became the Taliban. Afghanistan is an unwinnable country. The Soviets found that out. No, that's, you know, but that's Afghanistan. Iraq? Well, all the lies that were told about why we ought to go to Iraq tell us something about American control of foreign policy. The whole thing that Pat Fitzgerald is looking into, the whole thing about weapons of mass destruction, all of the documentation that this administration planned to go after Iraq. You could talk about oil pipelines, you could talk about Halliburton, you could talk about a lot of things, but the historical lesson is that this country needs to confront, to deal with, to understand the Muslim world. And it cannot simply do over again what the French and the English tried to do, who poured out the blood of their young men and billions of their treasure in ways that put the situation into where it is right, just as bad as it is right now, in my opinion. So it was wrong to invade Iraq. It was correct to oppose Saddam Hussein. It was correct to seek his downfall by whatever means, because he had plenty of folks in the Arab world that were interested in that. But it's time for a new look at American foreign policy, one that would not cost the hundreds of thousands, at least 100,000 lives that the Iraq adventure has already cost, if we count the Iraqi civilians. That's a debate that needs to happen. Now, I understand that's not a position you agree with, but I think that isolating the jihadist forces within the Islamic world is a process that is going to require a different approach than the one that this administration has taken. That's my opinion. Yes, sir, in the back.
I guess I've got two questions. At least they're both predictions, and I like to ask predictive questions because I always get them wrong myself. My first question is, do you think that the judges, the federal judges themselves, actually care about preserving their independence? And let me say what I mean by that. It seems to me a good part of the store was already given away by the Supreme Court in the Hamdi case, where the category of enemy combatant as unlawful combatant was essentially embraced, and the idea that our government could hold a citizen in that status subject to, you know, only hearsay evidence, and thank God the affiants have to be knowledgeable for their hearsay evidence. I don't know what an ignorant affiant is. But we hearsay evidence, a supposedly neutral tribunal that's a military tribunal, a presumption in favor of the government, and this was viewed as a liberal decision. It seems to me that in some respects the battle is lost. And then if you look at the various decisions of the lower federal courts in terrorism cases, they all involve essentially deference to the executive branch's supposed knowledge of foreign policy, because it's their job under Article 2 to know it. And every judge in the world is scared to death that something terrible is going to happen on their watch if they say anything bad to the administration that the administration doesn't want to hear. Now, it seems to me, in light of these two things, we have every reason to wonder whether the judges themselves are prepared to assert their own independence, regardless of what we lawyers do. Second question, a lot shorter than the first one. You mentioned the Lynn Stewart case. To what extent do you think that our government has got a strategy of trying to quash our own independence as a profession? And to what extent is the Lynn Stewart prosecution and conviction evidence of that? And on that one, I've got a lot more doubt. First one, I guess, might have been a rhetorical question.
Well, federal judges do suffer from this self-inflicted wound of which you speak. That's what Patrick Henry was talking about in the Virginia Assembly. You know, are they going to be willing to get up in the morning and even try? And that's true. I think it's only a kind of working minority of federal judges that are willing to stand up to the administration and deal with the hassle. And even as Judge Bill Childs, clerk for Judge Rosenbaum, found in departing downward in sentencing cases. Then you get called back to Washington and they start, you know, leaning on you. When in 1969, yes, it was 1969, John Mitchell, Attorney General Mitchell, announced that there was warrantless wiretapping of domestic organizations and national security cases. He sent the Deputy Solicitor General out to Chicago to argue, and I argued against him, and we lost there. And then we lost here and here and here, and, you know, district judges, none of them would deal with it. Then finally, Judge Warren Ferguson, in a Black Panther case, United States versus Smith, in which I was fortunate enough to represent Mr. Smith, held that you couldn't do it without the Fourth Amendment. And that then Judge Keith did it a couple of weeks later, and then the Supreme Court gets it, and 7-2 they held, yeah, the Fourth Amendment means what the Fourth Amendment means. The Supreme Court did uphold the Japanese relocation. They decided the Kahanamaku, the Hawaii martial law case, on narrower grounds. The answer is yes. It is difficult. Judges have, even Supreme Court justices, been reluctant to confront assertions of executive power. Yes, that has been an uphill battle. But, you know, that's the only game in town, right? I mean, the I was arguing a case up there called United States versus Salerno. United States had gotten cert off a Second Circuit opinion. This really is relevant. It's not just a war story. And I pointed, it was clear to me that we weren't going to get five votes for what the Second Circuit had done, but maybe the result was right. So the Chief Justice asked a question, and I said, you know, the court can affirm the Second Circuit on any ground whatever if it's convinced the result was right, even one the Second Circuit didn't cite. And Chief Justice Rehnquist said, yeah, but only if we want to. And I thought, that's right. You know, you got the only handle on the jack. You know, you guys don't do this. The car's not going up. We're not going to change this tire. You know, that's it. So, you know, that's why this system of government we have may be the worst in the world, except for all the rest. You know, I'm not sure. So, yes, how do we deal with it as advocates? There are times when, as advocates, we are required to say to judges, to talk to them about their Article III responsibility, to talk to them about abdication of that responsibility and what it means. And there are plenty of examples to hold up as to courageous judges and what they did and why they should be saluted, and you can look at those in legal history. But yes, I understand the problem. On the other hand, federal judges had to get a complete turnaround about the legality of what the draft system was doing during the Vietnam War, the latter part of the Vietnam War years. Justice Souter moved from his first term when he sat over next to Justice Scalia. Then he got his own chair and really, you know, changed his views. Justice Blackmun, we were talking about earlier, changed his. Things happen to people. Things happen to people. And it's up to you as an advocate to figure out how to reach the judge in ways that the judge might not even, you know, realize needed reaching. That's your job as the advocate. Right? Why? Because nothing else you can do. You might as well do that. And never waive a jury, right? Because wouldn't you rather have 12 prejudiced people than one doing your case? And I'm serious about that. Now, the second one, the Lynn Stewart case. I tried that case, yes, and we lost. Yes, I'm convinced that was to teach a lesson to a feisty, opinionated lawyer. That case was about speech, only speech. Yes, Joe, she's convicted of all of these charges. Well, sure, she's convicted of providing personnel to a conspiracy to kidnap or kill in a foreign country. The providing of personnel consists of repeating some remarks by her client, the old blind sheikh who's not in a position to do anything, under circumstances where the immediate reaction from the movement the sheikh is supposed to have led is, we don't want to do that. No guns were ever found. No person was ever kidnapped. No person was ever killed. I said, Judge, could you help us out here? What country was this supposed to have taken place in? Because it's, you know, conspiracy to kidnap or kill in a foreign country. So I said, they don't have to tell you. It's not relevant. I said, well, Judge, it is relevant because they've mentioned the West Bank. The West Bank's not a country. Right? Element of the offense. Okay, just give us a general idea. Who was supposed to have been killed? They don't have to tell you. Well, who was supposed to be kidnapped? They don't have to tell you. Well, think about it. When the charges are so vague, a discussion of possibilities lends itself to a conspiratorial explanation. Right? The ordinary idea of conspiracy is that you have a very specific intention to accomplish a fairly specific unlawful result, even under the modern view of conspiracy. So, yes, the choice of charges there, and I tell you, that's from the structure of it. You know, the judge dismissed the first indictment on First Amendment grounds. Then they came back and superseded. And the supersession made clear. See, the local prosecutors wanted to appeal the dismissal of the first indictment because, after all, a federal district judge had held a federal statute unconstitutional. I wrote to Solicitor General of the United States, Ted Olson, and I said, Ted, don't authorize the appeal. The judge got it right. In order for the government to appeal in a criminal case, they have to get the Solicitor General's approval. I get invited to Washington to conference on my letter. I'm going to tell you something. That's happened only about half a dozen times in my life. I get down there, and I get in this meeting, And we've got this right-wing nut of an assistant attorney general. We've got the whole Bush administration crowd of politicos in there. And I realized that maybe they weren't going to let the government appeal this case, but that no good was going to come of this. These folks were in it for the, you know, for the big time. So, yeah, I think that's a, you know, that's something you got to worry about. But folks, what a badge of honor, right? I'm serious. I represented a guy named Dominic Gentile, state lawyer in Nevada. Dom held a press conference the day after his client was arraigned. And he said, when we go to trial, I'm going to prove that my client, who ran one of these storage sheds, and there was some money and dope that the Las Vegas police had in the storage shed and it went missing, that my client didn't take the money and the dope, that the Las Vegas Police Department took it. Okay. Now, 6 months later, the trial was held. The night before he held that press conference, Dom researched the law and said he thought he was entitled to do it. At the trial, none of the jurors remembered the press conference on voir dire. They remembered some of the prosecutor's press conferences, but they didn't remember his. Dom did indeed show, as a part of the defense case, that the Las Vegas Police Department sergeant had put the evidence up his nose, and who knows what he did with the money, and the jury acquitted the client. The next week, Dom gets a letter from the state bar. We're disciplining you for your press conference. It violated the bar rules. And we're going to give you a letter of reprimand. Well, you know, he could have just taken his letter of reprimand, but he didn't. He said, I'm not taking a letter of reprimand. I want a hearing. Goes to the Nevada Supreme Court. The Nevada Supreme Court upholds the discipline. Now Dominic Gentile is all over the place as the guy that broke the disciplinary rules, right? He said, well, not so that. So my partner Sam Buffone and I, we went and we sought cert. We got cert. So he took it to the Supreme Court, even though he could have just done a laydown. 5-4, the court majority holds that the rule is unconstitutional, under which he was disciplined. A different five-justice majority dilutes the standard for lawyer speech. You can read the opinion. But, you know, Justice Kennedy writes a magnificent opinion about lawyers as public citizens. Why? Because Dom Gentile decided to stand up and say, I'm willing to put my reputation on the line to uphold the right of lawyers to do this. You're going to face these decisions in your practice, one way or another. You know, they may sneak in. You might not recognize them as such. But when you do, you know, you'll know what to do. Long answer to a short question. Thank you.